Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Joining me today is Peter Antos. Sorry, Peter. Peter Antos Ketchum, who is the coordinator for the New Community Project. Peter, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Sorry, I mangled your name. That was very strange. My glasses got stuck in my headpiece here, so I couldn't see. Anyway, today we're going to talk about some things that are very near and dear to my heart: food justice, food security, and food sovereignty, which I find it very concerning when we talk about these things in an agricultural state. So, Peter, can you talk a little bit about your background and how you came to join the New Community Project?
Sure. Yeah, I'm from Vermont. I grew up in Middlebury, and with the exception of a couple of years at a college outside of Boston, getting my experience with urban life, I have been here working in the state of Vermont. Prior to joining New Community Project back in 2015, I had worked for the Green Mountain Club for 23 years, and so I've been working in various Vermont communities around the state, working with different partners to protect and maintain the Long Trail. But New Community Project, that was it's a little bit of a story insofar as I came to it sort of in a roundabout way, which was I was cleaning out a box of things from my mother's place after she had passed away. This was a number of years ago, and I found a journal that I'd kept when I was at Camp Keewaydin, which is down in Salisbury. And during the fall, winter, and spring, Camp Keewaydin is run as an environmental education camp for area school kids. And so back in the 80s, when I was in fifth grade, my class went there for a week to learn about ecology and conservation and the natural world. And my camp counselor was this very interesting fellow named Tom Benevento. And the only reason I was able to remember, his name and remember those memories was I kept his name in the journal because he clearly had an impression on me as a young person. Through the power of the Internet, I had come to find out that he had indeed led an interesting life from that point forward, working for a New Community Project. He started, we call it NCP for short, NCP Sustainable Living Center down in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And so by reconnecting with Tom after finding his name in the journal and just wanting to, and seeing how interesting the organization was, I wanted to reach out to them and see what possibilities there might be for me joining them.
That is great. And obviously New Community Project is beyond our borders here. It's a national organization.
It's actually international because we partner with non-governmental groups that share our values and mission in 9 different countries around the world. And that all stems from our director, and our director prior to joining New Community Project was working in the World Services Program with the Church of the Brethren out in Elgin, Illinois. And so, he had an international scope for his work prior to coming to starting NCP, and has expanded that since then because it's really, the idea of the new community that we'd all like to see extends well beyond the borders of Vermont, the U.S. It's really about joining hands with people all around the world.
Oh, that's really great. I'm very impressed. Can you talk about what the organization is, what actually gets done through the New Community Project work?
Sure. So there's, I guess the best way to describe it, it has sort of 3 layers, and we can kind of start with that top layer that I mentioned, which is the international layer, and then kind of work down to where I am and make the connection between a global project and Starkesboro, Vermont, where I am. But that top layer of work is focused on bringing people to these different countries where we're working. We call them learning tours, and our director, David Radcliffe, he leads anywhere from 8 to 12 of these trips a year to these different places around the world. And these are trips where people who come along are coming along to see and hear from the people who live in these places about their experiences with, and not positive experiences most of the time, with interfacing with our global economy and what that means for that place on the ground, both ecologically and then also from a human standpoint. So these, you know, we travel to places like the Ecuadorian Amazon, you know, where the indigenous communities are being pushed back and pressured by oil companies from China. We have in the Dominican Republic, where there's a lot of issues around the production of sugar. Lots of projects and partnerships in Africa, you know, where we spend a lot of time working on helping with girls and women's empowerment and education programs to try to help strengthen communities there. And then also in Asia as well, so in Nepal and Myanmar. So those are some of the places, you know, where we take these learning tours each year. Like our next one is in January, and that's going to be headed to Nepal, where we partner with a group there, which is the second layer of what we do, this partnership with these other NGOs. And that's where we help to capacitate them to do their work. And in Nepal, this organization is focused on helping to reintegrate women and girls who have been trafficked back into society. There's some difficult hurdles that are there culturally for women and girls who have escaped that life to get back into society. And so we partner with a group called Shakti Samuha, and they help to provide those training programs and microloans and housing and all those sort of things people need to sort of transition in their life. And so that's, you know, so we go around with these different groups and we listen to them and see what they need. So it could be our partners, Creative Solutions for the Environment in Malawi in Africa, you know, asking us to help them build a dormitory for girls in the rural areas to be able to go and stay at school so they can complete their education.
This all sounds so daunting, Peter, because is there a light at the end of the tunnel? And I guess it's just one step and one foot in front of the other and just keep addressing the issues, because you have just discussed a whole range of needs, not just about food, but about people and their lives. And when you say we, is we the organization or we you? Do you go on these trips?
No, I do not. So when I say we, I'm talking collectively about the organization. Just to sort of put this in context too, there's only three full-time staff people, including myself.
And
then we have some folks who are part-time, and we're all based throughout the country in our own home office locations.
Well, there must be a lot of support out there for what you do, and I can understand why. One of the things I read about the organization, it said it empowers people most marginalized and impoverished. How do you go about empowering the people in some of these countries when they pretty much have nothing, I would suggest?
Yes. Well, I think it's through creating these, you know, what we describe as constructive programs, whether that's in partnership with a group there or doing it on our own here in the States. The idea is to bring together people and to find resources and create, you know, the right setting by which, you know, programs can develop to try to address the issues that we're seeing. I mean, when it comes down to it, there's sort of New Community Project has two, you just read part of what I would call our more detailed mission statement. Mm-hmm. We like to, you know, first of all, we like to say we're a small organization with a big goal, which is to change the world. And then our more detailed one is about that idea of, you know, creating sustainable systems, helping people that are impoverished, and trying to create, you know, the foundation for a more peaceful and equitable world. Because really what it comes down to is wherever you look at where we're working around the world, we just want to give everybody has should have the opportunity for a fair shot at a decent life.
Right. That sounds fair.
When you come at it from that approach, you start looking at areas, whether it's, you know, housing or food or transportation or any of these sort of key areas, and there's work to do to help people.
Well, I read in on your work area there that you have three areas that kind of help you to transform any given area. It's food, transportation, and to build an environment that is sustainable. And you work with people both on a personal level and on a community level. Why are those three things, if I'm reading this correctly, the core of what the issues are?
I think it goes back to something I remember from my very brief introduction to psychology and sociology back in college, which was, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that idea that there are core things that as human beings we all need in order to be to thrive, right? Not to survive and thrive. And it sort of builds out from those core areas of things like, you know, safe, warm shelter, you know, adequate, nutrient-dense food. You know, in the case of a place like Vermont, where we're very rural, we need to have access to transportation of some kind in order to, you know, meet our daily needs and arrangements. And so when you kind of look at those, you look at it from that lens, you recognize that, you know, let me take it a step back, and that when we look at the big intractable problems of the world, it's very hard for us to think about solving those unless we can help everyone to meet their sort of core basic needs. If people are struggling to just survive and to just get by day to day, week to week, hour to hour, it's going to be very hard to bring everybody together to tackle big problems. So we really ought to be looking at, you know, looking at our work from that sort of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be creating programs to help support people with those basic levels and those basic needs so that we can then come together to tackle, you know, bigger projects and bigger problems that
great.
We all face.
I'm back to that word daunting. So I want to talk just quickly about something that makes me crazy. Food insufficiency or food insecurity. A while back, it was 1 in 4 Vermonters dealt with food insecurity. Then it became 1 in 3. And now I recently had the food bank folks on, and they said it's even gotten higher, 2 out of 5, which, if my math is correct, is 40%. What is happening,
right,
Peter?
Well, I think you're seeing sort of the cascading effects of a lot of different problems all coming together driving this. And, you know, there's issues around the cost of housing. There's lack of economic opportunity. There's inflation on food and the cost of energy and even buying used cars. I mean, just thinking about the number of people I work with now who used to get around and, you know, I would say vehicles that were, you know, barely hanging on,
right,
but they were still getting around, and now they're on foot. Because they just can't find affordable transportation. And so, I think when we hit the pandemic, it exacerbated a bunch of problems that probably really got kick-started during the financial crisis in 2008.
Right.
And were never really resolved for a lot of people. I mean, I know in Vermont, when we look around, we feel like we came through relatively unscathed by that crisis relative to other parts of the country. But I think there's a significant part of our population that did not, and it's just the part of the population that not everybody sees or interfaces with on a daily basis.
Peter, we have to stop now and take a quick break, but I want to hold that thought because I'm not finished talking about this. In this agricultural state, it's a good topic to have. I'm Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We'll be back in a minute. Hi there, I'm back. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. I'm being joined this morning by Peter Antos Ketchum, who is the coordinator for the New Community Project. And we were just talking about food insecurity in Vermont. And Peter, I just always say that you don't know what's behind those closed doors in people's houses, what they're dealing with. And I read somewhere that food insecurity is one of the things That's where you hold back on money. That's the first thing, because you have to pay for the mortgage, you have to pay for the electricity and the heat. But food is somewhere where you can hold back a little bit, and so you just never know what people are dealing with. And the folks that are coming to food shelves and kitchens, they're a little different over the years. The group's gotten a little different. Would you agree with that, or has that been your experience?
Definitely. And I would just add that, you know, in a state that's largely rural like ours, it's difficult. You know, you talked about closed doors. It's not just closed doors. It's that the fact that people are spread out. They're up at the end
right.
of the roads, mountains, and the hills. It's harder to see when people are having difficult times, like compared to when you're in a bigger town where you can see people walking around and you can kind of see people that are experiencing difficult life circumstances. It's a little more hidden here in Vermont, and I think that makes it a real challenge to address.
Yeah, I agree, and I always tell people, don't assume You can't judge what people are dealing with unless you've, you know, walk a mile in their shoe, I guess. When we first started to talk, you asked that you wanted to talk about three areas in specific, which was food justice, food security, and food sovereignty for Vermonters. And first of all, I noted that you went on the positive. These are serious issues, but you didn't say food injustice, food insecurity, and lack of food sovereignty. You really approached it more on a, this is what we're going to do. We're going to fix it. And so I appreciated that. Could you talk about these three areas? We could start with food justice and maybe talk about what's happening to, and well, first of all, define food justice and what that means.
Well, I think, you know, what it means to, you know, our group and our work is that, you know, it's taking that idea of everyone deserves a fair shot at a decent life and applying that to food, because that's so foundational for how people are able to be well, be healthy, to achieve their full potential. I mean, we hear a lot about this when, you know, in relation to kids in school and their capacity to learn and so on, if they're not getting enough food or not good nutrition. So, you know, to us, the idea of food justice is a system whereby, you know, people are not relegated into a place where they are making those impossible choices you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, which what do they pay, and if they end up shortchanging food, you know, what that does to their health and well-being and their longevity, which, you know, we all know that that's not good. And so that's, you know, to us, that's what food justice is creating systems and creating a culture whereby we don't have issues of food insecurity. And on top of that, you know, I talk a lot about nutritional insecurity, because it's one thing to get people calories. It's another thing to get people the right calories.
Good point.
So that's something we talk about a lot, is that in, that important point. And our programs that we run here in Starksboro are focused on helping to ensure people have that nutritional security as well as just food.
Peter, I'm just thinking about, is there a place on the web or somewhere where all of the food kitchens or food pantries that are available in Vermont, is there somewhere where they are listed, because you're in Starksboro and you've got a wide area that you can cover, but here in central Vermont, maybe not, but yet we've got the food bank and Capstone. And I'm just wondering, is there a place where someone can go and get a list of where these places are? Because we certainly do try in Vermont to help folks. I'll give us that.
Well, you know, a wonderful resource we have here in Vermont, and it really came through and shown during the pandemic and has continued to, is the 211 resource people can call.
Right.
Vermont 211. I know we're going to talk a little bit about hunger councils here in a little bit, but they are part of our, they have a representative that joins our meetings on the hunger council, and you know, they help to make sure that the latest information is out there on resources for people. I mean, I've seen some things on the web, Pat, but they're not always updated,
right?
You know, or current. And for example, you know, here in Starksboro, we have New Community Project, but we also have a town food shelf too.
Mm-hmm.
And we work together. Our two programs are, we call our program Food Share, and theirs is the Food Shelf, and we work together to help, you know, increase food.
Bad on me. I'd never think of 211. I think I should have them on the show and get people to understand what 211 is all about. Shame on me, because that's a great resource. Because you don't see these places too often, because they're, you know, they're in a building or in a facility, or you think about the food bank and you don't relate it perhaps to a food shelf. So that's great. Thanks for that information. The next thing that you wanted to talk about was the Energy Justice Program and one of the other things that you and I were talking about food security. So maybe you could talk about that. And what is food insecurity, by the way? I mean, is there a definition for that?
I mean, I've seen several different definitions, but I think it really comes down to that concept of not having a guarantee, you know, being able to meet sort of what's considered a baseline recommended amount of calories in a day. I mean, it's pretty basic, I think, when it comes to from a health perspective. And I don't know that it really dives into, like, you know, calories versus the right kind of calories per se, but it's really about what's necessary for survival. And if people are food insecure, they may be not meeting that on a regular basis,
right? Wow.
Daily, weekly, whatever that may be. And think that's really that idea of food insecurity.
Yeah.
And then we would like people to be food secure.
So right, for sure. Anyway, what is let's talk a little bit about your energy justice program, because I see what's listed under here, and it's going to be needed this year for sure.
Yeah, and that, again, that's sort of when you mentioned earlier, sort of what were the stars that were aligning that were really creating a lot of pressure on people right now, and energy, you know, along with food, you know, is a big piece of that. We know that we live in a cold place, and we need to heat our homes, and we also have some of the oldest housing stock in the U.S., like my house included, which was built in the 1850s, and you know, some places only had newspaper in the wall for insulation. There's a lot of folks living in homes like that. There's also a lot of folks living in trailer courts. There's folks who are living in, you know, old camps that have been converted into four-season dwellings. And so there's a concept out there called energy burden, and that's the idea that you, because of your housing situation, you're paying relative to your income, that your costs for energy are that much higher. Relative to your income, and it's a real burden because you have lack of insulation, for example, so you're paying more for heating fuel. And at the same time, through no fault of your own, you're also, you know, impacting the environment more because you're burning more fuel. And so our energy justice program is sort of it's complementary to our work with food, which is that we want to make sure people are not in a desperate situation for energy, for their safety, number one, but also number two, so that they are not in that position of having to choose between heating or eating. So, you know, we've created a program that sort of has a couple different pieces to it. One is we have been working to, for people who are interested, helping them navigate and enroll in the state's weatherization program, which is a really great program. It just, you know, it has some paperwork, and it has some, you know, informational requirements, and sometimes, you know, people need a hand pulling that material together and sort of shepherding it through the application process. Mm. So that's one role that we can play here in helping people enroll in that program and getting the envelope of their home improved. The second piece is emergency heating fuel, whether that's conventional fuels or firewood. We've established a wood bank here in town, and you mentioned we've got a potentially rough winter ahead. We've laid in three times as much wood as we would normally put up for a winter to be prepared for the calls that we expect to get. And we're trying to fundraise to have adequate funds for being able to assist people with other heating fuels if they don't have a wood stove.
I keep seeing the word kerosene, and from my youth growing up, that was always considered to be not a safe fuel to use in your home. I tell you what, hold that thought a little bit, because we've got to take a break, and we'll talk a little bit about kerosene. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEB.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. I'm back with Peter Antos Ketchum, and we are talking about all kinds of things, food justice, food security, and food sovereignty. And, Peter, we have a caller, Ted from Shelburne. Ted, do you have a question for Peter?
Yes, good morning. Well,
morning.
And comment. It is it's interesting to hear the beginning in summer camp. And although I didn't, as a child, do summer camp, I was a counselor for a few years at Camp Killooleet over in Hancock, and it's a great age to learn basic things. And relevant to that is also in the consideration of the phrase you used of building a better world, I think, or changing the world. Rootsofempathy.org is a very interesting educational component that it works with early children building better social emotional selves, kind of. There are things in our culture which appear to be not doing that. So it's an approach to that. And with food insecurity, it is really never mentioned the nutrition and capacity to be fed by going outdoors and finding edible plants that are in your yard or weeds in your garden or whatever. And it just, because it's never mentioned, is why I wanted to call. And also just the pleasure I'm having getting acquainted with you and your organization. I've had ties, although I've not lived in Addison County. I've had professional and personal attachments there.
Oh, great.
I think that's enough, but it would be great to look at rootsofempathy.org.
I wrote it down. We'll see what we can do, Ted.
It's been experienced and researched in schools since 1996, mostly in Canada, but around the world as well. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Ted, do you have, Peter, do you have any comments or?
I really appreciate that call from Ted, and certainly I think, you know, a couple of things that he pointed out. I mean, yes, I think that's the real genius of Camp Key Wade in particular, is just that age group that they approach with that teaching. It's the program started by Warren and Barry King, who are pretty famous folks in the Vermont scene, environmental education scene down in Ripton, and the program continues to this day, and it's still continuing to help shape young folks and thinking about their place in the natural world.
That's great, especially when they're at that age, when they're just like sponges, and they can just absorb it and understand it, which is great. Is your facility, I have another caller, but is your facility in Starkesboro open so people can come in and talk to folks and see what's happening?
Yeah, that can be arranged by appointment, but yes.
Okay, cool. That's great. We have Fred from Newberry on the phone for a question for you, Peter. Fred, go ahead.
No, this is more of a comment. Let's see. I'm trying to think of the word here. The greatest reason why we've had migration in this country was caused by an energy problem, and the big energy problem was massive volcanic eruptions were the reason why people migrated, because it reduced the energy in the area that the volcanic eruption occurred. Pinatubo reduced the Earth's temperature by almost 1 degree centigrade way back when, and that was only, 25, 30 years ago.
Interesting. Well, I can see why one would want to leave after a volcano erupted, but I think that's interesting about the aftermath, Fred. So thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. Peter, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I was working in the White Mountains of New Hampshire when the winter that was sort of kicked on by, I think it was the Pinatubo in the early 90s, when that really kicked in New England. And remember the excessive snow that winter was something to be seen. And I think it speaks to a broader point that, yeah, there's, you know, when we think about food security in the future, we have to think about environmental challenges that will make food production in areas of the country that we've depended on more difficult, whether that's droughts or fires or other factors, and that's kind of pointing towards our sort of bigger purpose, which is to help Vermonters reimagine what it means to be, you know, food independent again and create our own locally sourced food supplies and not be so dependent on the broader world for our daily needs for food.
Great. Back to my question. I'm probably old, so I remember electric heaters and kerosene wasn't something you wanted to rush to keep you warm. I'm assuming that the containers have improved over the years, and are they a reliable source of heating if you run into trouble at home?
Well, I think you have to. Yes, you're right. There is a classification of kerosene heaters, which I think can cause local fire department folks to stay awake at night. You know, it's the unvented heaters, freestanding unvented heaters that can create problems for folks if they're not managed very carefully. You know, like any flame device in your house, from a candle, you know, up to one of these things. But you know, kerosene, there's all different types of kerosene heaters that function just like regular heating sources. In fact, when I moved to Starksboro, our first house had two of these. They're called monitors, and people may be familiar with those units, but the little unit that sits on the wall, it direct vents outside, and it ran on kerosene, and it brought its air in from the outside, it vented to the outdoors, it was extremely efficient and cost-effective. And you see a lot of people who, use kerosene as a heat source still around here, and I know that they're struggling mightily with the that's one of the fuels that's really increased in cost. I heard recently somewhere it could be up in $6 to $7
a gallon. Yep, exactly. Tomorrow we have a reporter coming on from 7 Days who wrote a really shocking, if that's the right word, article about how Vermonters are scrambling to find alternative heating sources and obviously cheaper heating sources. And the increase in things like kerosene is just it's staggering. I mean, I know in my home, just from a food perspective, we've made some major changes in the way we eat because I just can't spend that kind. It's not that I couldn't, but I can't spend $25 for a piece of steak. It's like, come on. It's I don't know how some people are managing it, and obviously they're not. So thank you for the work you do. He was in this article, they were also talking about the demand for wood. And I noticed you've got a community wood bank that, that you manage or deal with. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the wood bank, we started that several years ago, and it was partly through getting actually got a phone call from the folks who run the wood bank over in Moncton, nearby town, and they were telling me that, hey, we've been bringing emergency firewood to people up in Starksboro, which we're happy to do, but we heard you hear about your organization and wondered if you might be able to help with that. And so that's where we started partnering with our town to create a wood bank space where we could raise money and purchase firewood and then be in a position to deliver it. One of our main partners here in the area is Hope in Middlebury. And, they help us by fielding a lot of calls where people will call in looking for help, particularly with emergency heating. And if they're in our area, our service area, they will then route those folks back to us and help us get to help them.
Well, I know they said that if you haven't ordered your wood yet, you may not get it as soon as you would like this winter because it's a pretty tight market out there right now. And obviously, it's gone up as well. So,
yes.
We just stacked our wood the other day, thank goodness. Of course, and like with many Vermonters, we use both oil and we have a wood stove, so we supplement back and forth. And I'm sure we're going to be burning more wood this year than we have in the past. Could we talk, one of the callers mentioned food from outside, and I think that's fascinating. You go to restaurants and you have, flowers in your salad. Mushrooms are, some are edible, some are not, and that's what stops me from picking mushrooms outside. But it would be good to know those sort of things and be educated on what's around us outside.
That's very true because there are a lot of resources all right around us and some we don't even recognize. A lot we just think are weeds in our garden. I think of purslane is one that grows in our garden. I'm always looking at it and my instinct is to rip it out of the ground, but it's actually can be a useful edible. But it takes a lot of solid training and practice to safely harvest those things. And I think that's why, the caller noted that it's not talked about much. And I think that's, people are rightfully concerned about advocating that without people getting the adequate training.
Yeah. Well, there's not much room for error, is there? Like in mushrooms, if you eat a poison one, too late. And I don't think, and to me, they look so strange anyway, but as much as I love them. Anyway, we've got another caller, Peter. You're just attracting the folks this morning. Wade from Corinth. Wade, do you have a question for Peter?
I do. Again, kind of a statement, something I've been thinking about the last few weeks driving around. My job takes me all over the countryside. And hearing about your wood bank, and this may not be, part of your department, but maybe you have connections and maybe they're thinking about it. But with the ash borer beetle and municipalities and utilities dropping so many ash trees, in the town right away and state highway right away is off the side of the road. So the dangerous work is done. The trees are down. And I know that those can't be transported or shouldn't be from county to county. What if the Department of Corrections put some low-level inmates on crews out there, bucked it up, split it, and delivered it to households within those communities. Firewood.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of opportunities out there for creative. You see crews all the time just chipping stuff, which could be perfectly good firewood. And I think we're going to be possibly this winter there will be people regretting that we didn't take advantage of utilizing some of that.
Interesting. Thank you, Wade, very much for the question. And Peter, when we left, we were chatting about the community wood bank. And I think that the power companies, when they have to take down trees, they cut them and leave them on the property of the person that they're taking down the trees in case they want them. And I think if they don't want them, they get taken by the Capstone or one of the community action plans. I'm remembering that from a couple of years ago. I'm hoping that's the case. But anyway, the next thing on the list I wanted to talk about was food sovereignty for Vermont, which I kind of like the sound of that.
We talked a little bit about that before the break, which was just this idea of trying to make Vermont more food self-sufficient, resilient. We talk a lot about resiliency, that we're getting sustainable. These words all get tossed around and used in different ways. I think when we looked at we take the New Community Projects mission and we kind of use it like a lens and look around us, I mean, we see a tremendous opportunity, not just to help people who are in need, but to help all of us through reimagining how it is we meet our daily needs in a way that will be more secure in a seemingly uncertain future. I guess that's probably the best way to describe it.
I think educating the public is one of the best ways to really for us to understand food and its uses. And I know the food bank has, and I forget the name of it, where they bring in tons and tons of vegetables that were picked off of a farmer's off of the floor of the garden. And what you can do with these bruised and perhaps mangled vegetables, if you trim them and cut them, you've got food for another couple of days. And I think many of us don't do what we should do at home to make the best use of all food. And I just think people should be more educated on how to best use food, because we come from a remarkable place in this country and in this state who really tries very hard to take care of those less fortunate. I was just thinking the other day I saw a mushroom. It's called red hen mushroom. Do you know what they are? It's the strangest looking mushroom you've ever seen, but they were delicious. But that's something you probably wouldn't want to pick up if you saw in the woods. But anyway, I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking about the Hunger Council. There are 10 of them, I believe, in around Vermont, and you are the co-chair of the Addison County Hunger Council. Could you talk about the council and the work that they do and how it relates to the work that you do with your organization?
So the Hunger Councils are a program of Hunger Free Vermont, which is a statewide nonprofit organization that is focusing on ending injustice of hunger and malnutrition for all Vermonters. So they're a larger nonprofit, and we work with them through the Hunger Council. And the Hunger Councils are they're sort of like a partnership group. So, you know, for Addison County, the majority of the people that come in to our meetings are working on issues around food and food insecurity, nutrition, and so on. And they're doing it from different levels. I mean, we have people that are nutritionists from, Porter Medical Center. We have, nonprofits, both big and small. I would count us as on the small side, and then bigger nonprofits like HOPE or CVOEO. And even, like I said, we had a representative from 211. And we meet, we've been meeting monthly since the pandemic started because of the sort of demand and sort of the heightened need that we were all experiencing. And I started as a co-chair during the pandemic. Used to be that the Hunger Council met quarterly, but now they started meeting on Zoom during the pandemic, and we meet monthly because there's that much to talk about and there's that much need. And really what's wonderful about the Hunger Council is it brings together all these different entities, both, state or private or nonprofit, and together we leverage each other through sharing of information or connecting each other with resources. So here's a great example of how the Hunger Council worked for New Community Project is during the pandemic. We were able to make relationships with some new organizations we hadn't, like HOPE, mm-hmm. Was one of them, and AgeWell Vermont is another one of our partners that we work with to get prepared meals here into the community for folks 60 and up. The Middlebury Natural Foods Co-op helps provide donations to us now, and that's a connection we made through our partnership there in the Hunger Council. And so what it did is, you know, at a time when a small organization like ours was seeing tremendous need, and it was happening well after we'd already, you know, made our budget for the year back in January of 2020. And all of a sudden, I saw this greater need, but I didn't necessarily see the resources to meet that need. I had all these great opportunities come our way through our relationships in the Hunger Council that then helped us, rise to the occasion and meet those needs. And I think that story is very illustrative of the value and the power of groups like Hunger Free Vermont and the Hunger Councils.
Peter, how do you and the Hunger Free Vermont and others get a handle on how many people, Vermonters, are out there who need this type of help? I mean, I'm thinking of in Barrie, there are folks who live in the woods behind the city. I mean, and a lot of them live by themselves. You're mentioning older folks. They could be by themselves in an apartment somewhere, and who knows how they're struggling. How do you get a handle on the need out there? It's hard to figure out.
It is hard to figure out. And for us, for example, because our programs are mostly designed for people to come to us, we don't really have the capability always to go to people where they're at. We kind of only get a sense anecdotally. You know, I can count cars. You know, I got a clicker. I can count cars that are coming to Food Share and people. And I know, like, how many cubic feet of food, you know, we're putting out. And I have some metrics that kind of give a sense of the scope and scale of the need. And that's kind of what I use. I mean, none of it's perfect or completely scientific, but, you know, there are some harder, you know, like, for example, you mentioned gleaning.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that word. I never remember it.
So there's actually a Vermont Gleaning collaborative or collective, so that's all these different groups that work together to participate with farmers for gleaning. HOPE is one of them in Middlebury, and HOPE,
great.
For example, they brought us 2,200 pounds of gleaned produce last year.
Right. I did an exercise at the food bank one time where we actually gleaned the food that was brought in. It changed my mind totally about my home cooking and what I do with leftover food. And it's quite a lesson education-wise to learn about how much we throw out. And I was one of the worst offenders for years. And that one little exercise just bunked me on the head. And I approach things much differently these days.
Thinking about food sovereignty, two things that come to mind are, one, the average item in our grocery store here in Vermont travels 1,500 miles or more to get to the shelves. That's one thing. The other thing is that our industrial food system wastes up to 40% of the food we create in the country.
Yep.
Never made it to someone's plate. So those two metrics right there really drive me when I think about the need for Vermont to reimagine how we produce and use food.
Well, and especially since we're supposed to be an agricultural state, one would, and I love the farm to plate, you know, you go to a restaurant and, it says where everything came from down the street from, you know, Joe's farm or whatever. I just love it that it's local, fresh, and, it just tastes better, I think, for some reason, but it probably does. So anyway, so the Hunger Council itself, You have all these folks on your council sitting and talking. How do you all work together from a statewide perspective? Is that through Hunger Free Vermont and they kind of reallocate any areas where there's particular need, or how do we look at the state as a whole?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to describe it, is that, you know, they're the Hunger Free Vermont is the statewide organization, and sort of they have the capacity, you know, to be at the State House for talking about policy related to these issues. They also help with, you know, but they kind of run the gamut from programs at the ground level and just making sure that those are happening right up to, you know, being a part of legislation and policy. And
is there a light at the end of the tunnel, Peter?
They're definitely one of them for sure, and I'm very happy that they found us. I should say, during the pandemic.
That's great. Well, we're glad you were there. You're welcome back anytime to let us know what's happening and what we can do to help. Check out Peter's organization, and it's the New Community Project, NCP. Peter, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it, and thank you for all you're doing for Vermont. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Hi there, everyone. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome back. Joining me this morning is one of my all-time favorite bosses, David Walk, who is currently the founder of Walk Leadership Solutions in Rutland. David, how are you?
Great, Pat. Wonderful to hear your voice.
Thank you. I'm so excited. I know we're going to get together for coffee one of these days, and I can't wait to see you. I'm going to read a little bio, if you don't mind. David Walk has dedicated his life to education both in and for Vermonters. He has been a teacher, counselor, principal, state senator, superintendent, Vermont Commissioner of Education, president of Castleton State College and Castleton University, and a member over time of 40 boards and commissions. And still working, David, right?
That's correct.
You're bad as me. Currently, as I said, he is the founder of Walk Leadership Solutions. And beginning, is this true, David, in 2023? David will be serving Rutland County as an assistant judge, Your Honor. That's great. Good for you. Well, do you know, because we served in the positions we did, we will always be considered the honorable David Walk and the Honorable Pat McDonald, but now you'll be, for real, Your Honor. So cool.
Well, you don't really change, but people call you by the job you have, whether it's senator or judge, and you start getting mail that says honorable, but you know it's not true.
I know, exactly. I get these things at home. I go, where do they get this stuff, the Honorable Pat McDonald? I show Bruce, of course. I said, see this, Bruce? See? The Honorable Pat McDonald. Anyway, we have got so much to talk about, and you were one of my bosses back when you were Commissioner of Education, so I thought, let's just start from that position and work our way to today.
Sure.
And so what did you – I asked this – what did you take away from that position when you left? I'll weigh in with my thoughts, but what did you take away after working with the Department of Education and its folks?
Well, what I remember most is the way you reorganized the place and transformed it. I remember we had to cut some employees. We had to reorganize, and you – opened up the place in Berlin. I think you called it the bowling alley.
Yes, right.
And so it was a wonderful experience for me to that was my first time meeting you and a whole lot of other people. And it's a job that I had aspired to try to inform, even in a small way, what was happening in education. I did feel that I was a little remote from the action when I was there. Gosh, I remember visiting my dad on my way home to Rutland from Montpelier one day. And so we had this conversation. He was in this assisted living facility, but still sharp as a tack. And he said, where you been? And I told him, and he said, gosh, how many schools have you visited since you've been up there? You're never in the office. And I said, well, somebody figured that out. It was over 100. And he said, well, you're very peripatetic. And I said, well, thanks, Dad. Then I had to go home.
Okay, look it up.
Look it up in the dictionary. I had no idea what it meant, but it meant somebody who traveled a lot. And it occurred to me that I really missed being in the action.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was commissioner, I tried to advance the expansion of school choice around Vermont, which was one of my main emphases there. And it didn't really work too well and hasn't since. We can talk about that maybe at the end.
But, sure.
I was there for just a couple of years, and then I was recruited to be president of Castleton, and I departed. But I had a great experience there, and I loved meeting you and getting to know you. And I really do think that your transformation of that place was an enduring and meaningful difference there.
Well, that's very kind of you. I really thank you. I remember I always felt – I could understand what you were feeling, because when you're a superintendent or president of Castleton, when you say, go do this, people do it. And I remember you and I had some conversations where I said, no, you can't do that because the statute doesn't allow it. And I read the descriptions of, like, principal, commissioner, and there's really not much direct authority, which I guess it's because of local control, but seems to me those statutes should be written a little bit more forcefully to get some things done. But that was my opinion back then, that that the only, which is a big control thing, is the budget. And that's pretty much the only, maybe have a lot of influence, but not direct control. And so anyway, I was glad, I was very glad for you when you went to Castleton. And I read somewhere where they called you the Pied Piper of Castleton and Rutland County, because you did so much to transfer Castleton from a small college into a university, with funding and programs and happy students. And could you comment on that journey that you took with the Castleton folks?
Sure. Thank you for all of that. I don't know about this Pied Piper thing.
That's what it said. The newspaper never lies, David.
Well, it was an embellishment, I think. So, you know, I grew up in Rutland County. I mentioned my dad. He was born there in 1919. So our whole family is really embedded in Rutland. And you know, Pat, Rutland is really similar to your listening area. There's so many connections between Rutland and Barrie and Waterbury, Montpelier, the whole area. Because, and Governor Scott talks about this a lot because, you know, he's from there. We're both kind of blue-collar places. There's no pretense. And I like it. I like living in a place like that where, you know, it's real. So, yeah, I've had this love for Rutland. I went to Middlebury College, not too far away, and except for some time in grad school and traveling, I've been in Rutland my whole life, and I love it, just like the people listening today love where they are. So I'm not sure I was a Pied Piper, but I do love it, and a lot of my work, you know, and all the boards and everything I've been on has been in this area. So with Castleton, I was there 16 years, the longest-serving president ever since 1787, and it was quite a jewel. You know, when I got there, I was quite impressed, immediately started referring to it as a small college with a big heart. And that was sort of our guide. And then it became the small university with a big heart. So we just had a lot of great people there. We set up a 10-year plan and then another 10-year plan. We followed it. We were sort of religious to what we needed to do to expand the place. And, you know, as you remember, the whole mantra for me is to treat students as if they're members of your own family. And so we did that. And expanded academic programs, co-curricular programs, sports, and invested close to $80 million in the in the school. And it's really paid off. Enrollment's grown, and there's been a lot of service to the Rutland area and actually to the state of Vermont. Some of that has been changed since I left. But
right.
For the most part, we could talk about that later, I guess.
Yeah.
I just, when I even talk about Rutland and Castleton, I get this warm feeling in my heart. I know that's kind of crazy, but that's
I actually love Rutland, and I love their downtown. I just, there's something about walking downtown in Rutland. It's just with the trains and the store. I mean, it's great. We go down as often as we can. And when you used to have those Friday night events, with people, out and about, I forget what they called it, but, we wouldn't miss it. We'd go down and shake hands and say hi to everybody because it's a great community.
Ride your motorcycle?
Oh, yes, for sure. We even rode we rode in a motorcycle. My husband rode Governor Douglas on the back of his bike in one of those rides from, and I shouldn't say this. I hope he's not listening. He kept turning around waving to people, and Bruce is trying to keep the bike straight up, you know? And when you're on the back of a bike, you're supposed to sort of sit there, and that he kept jumping around saying hi. And fortunately, my husband did not dump him, which would not have been good for the career. But anyway, but it's a great community, and I love it. But I wanted to highlight that such things as when you talked about the school itself, when you got there, there was one master's degree. And now you moved it to 10. There's 10 master's degree, and you added, you had plans to add doctorate and education and nursing practices. You've moved the athletic teams from 12 to 27. That's remarkable. That really is. And I think you must have energized people to, make it all happen through your leadership.
Well, it really wasn't me. It was that we had great people around us. We recruited a lot of people to help us. Yeah, there were fewer than 100 student athletes there, and we established a plan. We followed it. Now there's close to 800. You know, we brought in hockey and football for. I realized when I got there that, you know, UVM had dropped football back in 74, I think, and it was mind-boggling to me that Vermont was the only state without a public college or university football team. So we started hockey. We ended up buying the arena and fixing it up in Rutland. And, you know, the faculty was really opposed to it. And the chancellor at the time was not too fond of it either. But finally, the board of trustees said, you know, it's your college. Go ahead. And it turned out that it's been huge for the school, because the athletes actually have a higher grade point average and a much higher graduation rate than the general population. So the faculty, many were opposed to it, and then they figured out once these great kids came to the school, wow, they're making a difference. So, you know, developing hockey, at one time we had a national ranking in Division III, men's and women's, and we've got a wonderful, oh my gosh, we've got a great rivalry with Norwich. And for a while there, people around Castleton were saying, there goes Dave using the F word again. there he is using the F word. But it was all about football. And, you know, we had to build the facilities, you know, the stadium and the athletic center and everything else, the hockey arena. We had to do that to house these teams, because in Division III, you have to have capacity for these things. And it worked out great. It helped our academic majors. It gave Castleton a better image. Not just in Vermont, but around the country. Our recruiting went well. We got a lot of international students, a lot of out-of-state students. So it ended up being a really good thing. But it was hard at the beginning because a lot of people didn't believe it.
Well, they don't like change, David, do they? But anyway, that is a beautiful campus besides. It's just a lovely location with the mountains and a great downtown. David, please, in my research, I read about this 22,000-pound stone you took from Rochester Quarry and brought it to the campus. Could you tell the story about that and the tradition that followed?
Sure. This means a lot to me, Pat.
Oh.
That stone, you know, basically 11 tons, was in the Rochester Quarry. It's Vermont Baird Antique, which is very unique to Vermont. There are only two quarries in the world that have this beautiful green kind of marbled stone, and Cavendish in Vermont is the other one. So I went up to Rochester and had this sense that we needed to do something to sort of enshrine Spartan pride, but also to honor someone who was very important to me and to the campus. And that was my late wife, Diane, who people know around the state of Vermont because, in my view, she was the best educator I ever knew in my now 48 years of being in public service, and wanted to have sort of a symbol of courage and something that would mean a lot because everyone on campus knew her. Diane had an 11-and-a-half-year long goodbye with early-onset Alzheimer's. She passed away in 2015, actually just before we became Castleton University. And at that point, when we finished the stadium in 2008, 2009, just before our first football game, wanted to just, you know, many colleges and universities have a symbol where, you know, the players might touch it or kiss it on their way out or back to practice or a game. And so I guess I should make a long story short. The idea is that we wanted to have this permanent monument that would be there forever. And, of course, this will be there forever. It's a very heavy stone. And it was based upon, you know, Leonidas's response on the Spartan battle. This is 480 BC, when Xerxes wrote to Leonidas and said, hand over your arms, and he replied, come and get them, or maybe it was come and take them, and Molon Labe. So Molon Labe became the mantra, and it was all about courage, and in the stone, it's in honor of Dr. Diane Walk, and she was an amazing person. Like I said, everyone know her, and I remember in she was still in Vermont, and it was just before she departed to go where she wanted to be in 2009. I took her out there, and I was really hoping when I read it to her and that I could tell her what it was about that she would capture it, but she didn't, unfortunately. But maybe she had a sense of it. And I remember telling her about this scholarship in her honor that we had developed. It's actually the largest scholarship there now. And she didn't get that either, but she maybe had a feeling about it.
Yep.
And then she was where she wanted to be, away from her family and friends, because she was very courageous. She didn't want people to see her the way she knew she would be. She knew she was going to die. She didn't know when. So for the last few years, she was in this wonderful place, a memory care unit in Florida. And during those years, she didn't know, and she didn't know me, but she had, you know, as best as could be, a pretty good life until the end. But that huge stone will be there forever.
That's great.
And it sort of represents what's best about Castleton and Spartan pride, and certainly, in honor of this incredibly courageous woman.
Absolutely. That is a wonderful story. And I had met Diane on a couple of occasions, and she was so gracious, and I just loved her. She was a wonderful woman, and won a few awards, did she not, in her time teaching?
She was Teacher of the Year. Yep. She was Chair of the State Board of Education.
Yep.
Like I said, she was the best educator I ever knew, and great mom, wonderful wife. And, you know, sort of ironically, my now wife, Lynn, was a really close friend of hers. So
that's
amazing
great.
how life transpires, yep. I guess, over time.
That's great. Well, she really was a remarkable woman, and did a lot for Vermont. So we thank her. And that's a great tribute to have this, like, go Spartans. That's cool. So one of the things that people know about Castleton is not just so much the education part of it, but the polling institute, which has actually gone national these days. Could you talk about how this all came to be?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do, we had a bunch of entrepreneurial ventures, which were designed not only to support Vermont, but to bring in some revenue for the school as well, because with, at that point, declining state support, now it's increasing, but we needed to, you know, sort of expand. But the Polling Institute, which was run by Dr. Rich Clark, we recruited him, we did a plan for it, and it actually, I remember when it was quoted on some national shows for the polling that was done. When I left Castleton in 5 years ago in December of 17, the president who succeeded me closed the Polling Institute, unfortunately.
Mm.
Rich Clark, the professor of political science, is still there, and he's often quoted. I think he did a poll last year for Channel 3, but had to use folks from New Hampshire to help do the polling. But, yeah, so it was sad for me that some of the things that we had started were changed after I departed. But, you know, such is life. But that was a mirror of Vermont, and
right.
It was really helpful. It employed students and people in the area. The actual technology was in downtown Rutland, which brought people there. But, you know.
But what a great way to see Castleton in a different light. It's polling, and it's not education in the strict sense, but what a great way to introduce Castleton, and nationally, because I remember being a little bit of a political bug myself. I would always, when's the Castleton poll coming out? Because people relied on it.
Kind of disappeared.
Oh, that's too bad.
You know, Quinnipiac and Merritt have their polls, and we know them for that. There were a few things that changed after I left.
Yeah, well,
you've got to run a place, you've got to run a college or university like a business.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I know there are a lot of academics who don't like that when someone like me says you got to run it like a business, but you do. You need to survive. You can't have more expenses than revenues, so you have to augment your revenues, and
right.
That's what we did.
Right.
It's like running a business.
I know there's a few people in the Department of Ed when I worked there that couldn't quite understand why I was there because they didn't have an education background, and I would say the same thing, where you can apply the same theories and organizational structure. No, you can't. You need to understand education. But I think we
not
won
true.
Them over, and, though, David. Anyway, so you've got a couple of other entities. You've got the Castleton Center for Schools, the Castleton Downtown Gallery, and the Spartan Arena, which is actually, I think, at the mall. Is that correct?
That's right. It's the only thing left there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and somehow you met, and the students are involved in some of this to learn business and to learn how things operate in the real world. Is that not true?
That's right.
Yeah, that's great. Great experience.
We actually had, because we were overflowing, we built some new residence halls, the last of which was Hoff Hall, right at the stadium, wind-powered, solar-powered, at that, because sort of before our time. But then we ran out of room. There was no room at the end. So we actually developed downtown housing. So there were a number of upperclassmen and grad students actually living in rehabbed areas downtown. Mark Foley helped with that. And actually, Foley Hall downtown is where Castleton students still live. So we developed a few things to try to expand our reach. One was the Center for Schools, and we started that actually in 2002. And the idea is to provide graduate programs and continuing education for principals, superintendents, teachers all over the state. And quickly became, UVM wasn't as interested in it, and it became and still is by far the major provider of professional education in Vermont and actually outside of Vermont. So the Center for Schools is still going strong, actually creates a lot of revenue for Castleton University. And the other things we did, which were sort of service-oriented and entrepreneurial, were to develop the downtown art galleries. And, of course, having the students downtown was great for the economy. Not one problem, by the way, Pat, with students living downtown. No disciplinaries. These problems. These were mature, responsible students who were there. And then the Spartan Arena. We bought that from – it was about to go out of business. It was a regional field house.
Oh.
Put a lot of money into it to expand the locker room, the HVAC systems. We totally rehabbed it and had to do it because we had to check with the NCAA Division III. You had to have certain amenities. You had to have enough seating for, I think at that time, 800 people or 1,000 people. And that's when we started this wonderful rivalry with Norwich. Tomorrow night I'm going to go to the Spartan Arena where our women's team will be, I've been there 5 years, but the Castleton women's team will be hosting Norwich. We have this competition with them. Actually, the hockey competition, it's kind of cool. Whoever wins it gets the Walk Cup. And unfortunately, the Walk Cup has been up at Norwich the last few years.
Hopefully you'll get it back, David. I have confidence. That's great. David, we've got to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk more about Castleton and your decision to leave. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I am here with David Wolk, who is currently the founder of Wolk Leadership Solutions, which we're going to talk about now. So, David, in 2018, I believe, you decided to step down from Castleton as president. And I read where you said to your students, you left them with the following: make a difference here before you make a difference in the world. That is so true. And what a great message for the kids. Do what you're doing now as best you can, and then move on, because I think people are always looking for that next opportunity if they hate what they're doing. And you've got to do a good job no matter where you are.
Yes. So I actually said that to the students when they came to Castleton. And it was the last thing I said to them at graduation. So at the very end. So what I would do is, for those 16 years, I would have them up to the house, all of them. I would shake their hands, ask them who they were and where they were from at their orientation. And then I would shake their hand at graduation. And so there was sort of bookends to their experience. And I keep in touch with a lot of alums. In fact, I've married quite a few. I've done 37. I'm about to do my 38th wedding, and I love doing that. But anyhow, that's sort of an aside. The experience at Castleton, Pat, was just unbelievably transformational for me, and I hope for the students, because making a difference there and in the world was what it was about. I'll tell you a very quick story that the night before graduation for 16 years, I would drive students home. There was a local bar that they went to, and then there were parties. So I would drive the Safe Ride van, was more like a bus, every graduation the night before. And so there were students who, when I shook their hand the next morning, would say something. And about halfway through my time there, maybe about year 10, and I remember, you know, we had several thousand people there. And this girl comes by and shakes my hand and says, "President Walk, thanks for last night." And unfortunately, the mic was on.
And so
a hot mic, right. And Senator Leahy was there as the speaker, and I remember turning around, and he looked kind of horrified, and then everyone started laughing. And then I did what I shouldn't have done. I actually stopped and went to the microphone and tried to explain what that was about. And of course, you know, when you do that,
it makes it worse, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyhow...
That's
it was
funny.
A very special.
What
place.
A great thing to do, David. That's great. I actually used to volunteer at my daughter's high school for those events. So just, you know, you go pick them up, no questions asked. Just don't get sick in the car was sort of the rule. But anyway, that's very nice, Don. I'm sure the students loved you for that. So when you left, it must have been a big decision, and you decided to form a company with your wife Lynn, called Walk Leadership Solutions, and you've been doing that now, let's see, 2018, for a few years, 5 years, yeah. Is that right?
So we ramped it down. I didn't actually do that right away. My mother had Alzheimer's disease, and we were responsible for her, and it was getting a little worse. We left in December of 17, and surprisingly, she passed away about 6 months later. And she too was down in Florida. She was actually in the same facility that Diane had been in, ironically. And so we came back to Rutland and, didn't start that up right away. When we did, it was all about doing searches, strategic planning. And, I ended up not liking that very much. It was just too, I don't know, remote from the action. So then I get into mentoring new leaders and coaching experienced leaders. I went back to be superintendent in Rutland for a year when they were kind of desperate. That was a couple years ago at the beginning of COVID. And I realized that, you know, much as I liked doing that and Lynn liked doing that, wanted to do something that was more hands-on where you have, more follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just like a one-off where you're trying to help somebody and then you go away, but you want to have something more enduring. And so that's why I've decided to ramp that down and to do something different, kind of out of my wheelhouse, but still in public service. So like I said before, I've been doing this in education and government public service for 48 years, and I wanted to do something different, and that's why I ran for assistant judge.
That's great. And so can you explain what the role of the assistant judge is? What do you perform in the courts?
Sure. I'm glad to do that. It's pretty much an unknown entity. Each of the 14 Vermont counties has two assistant judges, often called side judges.
Mm-hmm.
And I frankly wanted to do it because I wanted to serve. I wanted to do something different. So the judges sit in civil court, family court, non-criminal cases, non-jury cases. They run the county budget, county courthouse, the sheriff's department, et cetera. And I mentioned family court. They also hear, in some cases, traffic violations, small claims, uncontested divorces. But the part that was attractive to me was learning something new,
mm-hmm.
serving, and the civil cases, the non-jury civil cases. Vermont is, I think, alone in having lay judges. You don't have to be a lawyer, but there's a lot of training involved, which
right.
is starting in right away. And that's, you know, presumed that you would do that. But, you know, for me, it's something that it's a 4-year term. Got elected on Tuesday with Steve Bernard, the other candidate. There are only two of us. I actually ran as an independent, Pat.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, the reason is that I think judges should be impartial and
Absolutely.
Independent. And, everybody can decide what they want, and almost everybody runs as an R or a D. But I just felt I'm going to run as an independent because you're supposed to be very impartial. And, there's a downside to it that I learned afterwards. There's a 51-page code of judicial conduct involving what you can and can't do.
Right.
Or the perception of what you can and can't do. The part that isn't so bad is that you can't have any involvement in politics, which is okay with me. You can't do lawn signs or endorsements or contributions, mm-hmm. et cetera. You got to be very careful about that, and that's fine with me. But the downside was that I was on the Prevent Child Abuse Vermont board, and I was on the Make-A-Wish Vermont board for a long time, and I had to get off those boards because there's a conflict there with a place. I don't know why Make-A-Wish is a conflict, but if you're involved with raising money or something, there's an implicit bias. So that's the only downside. I'm very excited about it.
It's great.
Because I want to do something different and meaningful.
I was on the board of Prevent Child Abuse Vermont for years. I love that group, and I love Linda Johnson. They do an amazing,
fantastic.
Amazing work. So thank you for that. That's great.
Well,
so when do you start your judgeship?
You don't know how to retire.
I know. Oh, it's something about sitting watching TV. It doesn't work for me.
No.
But so when do you start? Is this a July 1st?
It's February 1st, but between now and then, there's a lot of training that goes on.
In
fact, I'm sitting with the guy, Steve Bernard, who is the incumbent, to go over the budget next week and to get started with some ethics training and some other things.
Yeah, that's great. Well, with my hat with Campaign for Vermont, we pushed the ethics bill in the legislature. That was one of our goals, was to get an overarching ethics policy put in place for the judiciary, the administration, executive branch, and the legislature. So good for you. So listen,
good
I want
you.
To spend
we need more of that.
Yeah. It's a small state. I want to spend the rest of the time talking about education and talking about what's happening with higher education here in Vermont. I had the chancellor and Lynn Dickinson on, who is the chair of the trustees for the Vermont College System. Have you been following that at all? I know that people in Castleton were very much opposed to it in the beginning. I don't know how when I was covering it in the legislature. What are your views about what they're doing and where the future looks like it's going?
Well, I am not a proponent of what they've done with the merger or the name change. But these are good people who are trying to solve a big problem, which is, you know, changes in demographics, declining enrollments in some places, vacant buildings in some places.
Right.
And, when Jeb Spaulding was chancellor, I think he had some good ideas in terms of how to downsize. But then I got caught up with maybe the process of how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still, people who wanted to unify all the colleges and essentially to save money and become more efficient. And I understand that. But the big problem is that a place like Castleton, which has grown so much and has its own mission and mantra, if you will,
right.
and very loyal alums who feel very much outside that decision making. But it's going to happen. I mean, the merger is happening.
Yep.
It's becoming Vermont State University. And I feel badly about it. There's some at Castleton back then who would say that it was a hostile takeover. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, maybe it's not that, but it's certainly been problematic for folks at Castleton. I was hoping that they would allow the schools to keep their names. You know, I'll make an I'll equate it to this for people in Waterbury. They understand it. When Unilever bought Ben and Jerry's, you and I didn't go to the store and reach into the freezer and buy Unilever ice cream.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, Ben and Jerry's has a brand. Castleton has a brand. And I don't see any reason why Castleton couldn't remain Castleton University forever,
mm-hmm.
but still be part of this this corporate structure, not Unilever, but the Vermont State University. And I think for Castleton's welfare, because it's so unique, and this isn't elitist, it's just the way it is, that it would be much better for Castleton to keep its 343 green colors, its New Baskerville font signage, and its name, which means so much to the current
right.
students and the alums. I don't know if that's going to happen. Maybe in the sports part of it, it will. But I think it would be a mistake. I still think it would be a mistake to, you know, the Vermont State University is there and will always be there, but it would be a mistake to homogenize Castleton along with the rest. So that's, you know, bluntly how I feel about
no,
it.
Well,
and that's not to question anyone's intentions, which I know are forward-thinking and altruistic. It's just a very stark difference of opinion.
Well, but I've always looked at it because I have the SUNY background from where I came from, SUNY New York. And you're right about the location. It's SUNY at Plattsburgh. It's SUNY, you know, they would name the location. And each one of those locations would be known for a specific, whether it be business degree or the arts or science. Every one of the campuses specialized in a certain degree or degrees so that there wasn't any competition. And that's what I always thought would work here in Vermont. David, and we got about 10 minutes left and I wanted to, you've commented about the Vermont State College system. I had the, as I said, the chancellor and the chair of the trustees. And I must say, good or bad, they are working really, really hard. And if people say they haven't had an opportunity to weigh in, they haven't been paying attention because there is tons of opportunity to weigh in and to have your voices heard. I know there are a lot of people that agree with you, but I think the legislature is focused on the merger of all the entities. I think that's sort of a done deal at this point.
Yeah, I want to make clear that I'm not opposed to the merger.
Right.
And I think there's a lot to be said about saving money and becoming more efficient. I just don't want the schools to become homogenized.
Right.
And I'd like them to be able to maintain their unique.
Well, I hope there's time for that because I think each, like especially Castleton and, because I always thought the whole thing should be called Lyndon Johnson if they want name recognition. What a deal. But we digress. But anyway, I think there may still be room for that discussion because I think each campus has to have a uniqueness about that would attract people, whether it
right.
be the specialties that they offer. What I'm thrilled about is the attention being paid to the Vermont Tech Centers because I love tech ed. And that's what our business is. I know when you and I worked together, we brought in business people to talk to the educators in the department about how they're desperate for people to train and who like to work with their hands and do technical sort of work. And I think that's exciting.
That's a good segue into school choice, Pat.
Yep, sure. Yeah, please. Can you
mention something about that?
Yeah, I love, yeah, please. I love, I'm a strong proponent of school choice and, Campaign for Vermont has worked on that, a lot. And you said you're a supporter, which is good to hear.
Always have been. And, you know, I got to be careful. I don't get involved in too many political issues here in my new role, but this isn't really political. It's more policy.
No, it's educating kids and choices.
You mentioned tech ed and they are shiny examples. the tech centers around the state of school choice. The kids who go there want to be there. Their parents want to be there. They don't have any discipline problems. The students there are focused on careers, and it's because they chose the program and they chose those tech centers as part of their education and career preparation. And the important part about that related to school choice is, and I don't know if you remember this, but this was 25 years ago, almost that or more. But I've always been a proponent of school choice since the 1970s because, you know, I've worked in a Catholic school, independent school, mostly public schools, and where there has been school choice, particularly at the high school level, the schools are much better for two reasons. One is that competition is a good thing, and two is that it creates more opportunity. So if you look at those two ideas, competition, opportunity, school choice could radically enhance the quality of education in Vermont. There are many places in the country that have it. And there are actually 90 towns in Vermont that do not have designated schools, and those kids have school choice. And my feeling since the beginning has been that there ought to be school choice for everyone, because not every school is the right match for every kid. If parents don't like a school, say there are conflicts or there are discipline problems, and they have the opportunity to go somewhere else with a new attitude, a clean slate, that makes so much sense. But we don't have that in many places. And, you know, I remember advocating for this in my state of education speeches, and when I was there with you in the department, tried to get the governor at the time, Governor Dean, to support charter schools. I think now he does. And I tried. There were sort of entrenched parts of education that didn't support school choice. But now, I think given, you know, the advance of technology and the recognition that choosing schools makes sense. I mean, John McClary has been supportive of this for decades.
Right.
And I agree with John that this is one way to enhance education through better opportunities for kids and through them, their parents. And competition's not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
There are issues that obviously have to be addressed, transportation, special education to make sure there's equity for students. And in many places, that's happening. So when you talk about the state of education in Vermont, one way to really enhance the quality of education is to expand school choice.
That's great. Whoa, you've got my vote, David. We have another caller whom I'm sure you know, David Kelly. David, how are you? Thanks for giving us your last name. I'd know who it is. How are you?
Well, Pat, it's always great to hear your voice. And what I wanted to run by Dave was how he would feel about making tuitions for juniors and seniors in high school portable to any other accredited school. Mm. And that would include foreign exchange programs so that if you're a junior and senior, your grades are good. Essentially, your tuition dollars become portable to enhance choice.
Mm.
Totally agree, David. That would expand opportunity for students, and it makes sense to have the money follow the student. They advocated for that for a long time. And we have some variation on that theme, David, with early college now, where seniors and some juniors can actually go to college in Vermont and get credit for dual credit. That is, they get credit for high school and they get advanced the startup on credit for college. But your idea about enhancing students' education, whether it's foreign exchange with credit or to other schools, makes total sense because it focuses on those two points, opportunity and enhancing competition.
That's great. Well, it's always been about the money, hasn't it?
You know, Pat, you said, I've got your vote, and I'm not involved in politics.
Sorry, it's my nature. I think in terms of voting, got my vote. But anyway, it has always been about the money with school choice, hasn't it? That the schools don't want to lose that money going with the student, and that's been the issue. Of course, I think as much as I hate to see my taxes go up, I don't think we spend as much as we should on higher education or education for that matter. But I know we spend the most in the younger grades, but higher ed is lacking.
Yes.
Because I know when I had a big argument one time with one of the newspaper reporters about UVM being a public school and they should give out their list of donors. And I said, we give them so little money. I don't know how we can even call it a public school because they have to compete with the private schools to get money. We give them so little. So, and I'm sure it works.
One idea might be to allocate state funding per Vermont student, whether it's at UVM or the state college system. So you're keeping money in state. You're actually giving incentives for students to stay in Vermont. So if the schools, including UVM, were rewarded for educating Vermont students using Vermont tax dollars to do so, that would make total sense.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, David. The Honorable Assistant Judge David Walk. I love it, David. I have to go check you out in your robes. Very nice.
We know that's not true. Actually, Pat, my son said, who's a lawyer down in New York City, he said, Dad, I love you, but I'm not going to stand up when you walk in the room. I'm definitely not going to call you, Your Honor.
Exactly. He's got his priorities good. David, thank you, and thank you for everything you have done for Vermont, and thank you for being a good friend. We'll see you soon over coffee. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.